Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance, live from the Kintech Studio. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and rental warriors for over 50 years. Visit them in one of their three locations to serve you or online at DunbarLumber.com. This hour of Canucks Talk is brought to you by Rack Steel. Rack Steel has the expertise to get you operating faster with forklifts and pallet racking in stock. Visit them online at racksteel.com. Packed show today. We did the crossover. We've still got Jason Bukala coming up at 1, Mike Medano at 1:30. So an abbreviated segment here. We won't do an official edition of the whiteboard, but we can run through everything to kind of get you set up for Canada versus Sweden. And, you know, as I was just saying before we got into the crossover in the first segment, Drance, very curious to see what the early pace is. Like, first 5 minutes, what's the intensity? What's the pace? The atmosphere, I think, is going to be fantastic in Montreal. But watching for that kind of moment which could elevate the intensity, right? Whether it's a big hit, an early goal, a great play, something like that. And just very curious to see what it looks like right out of the gate and whether it ramps up significantly as the players kind of get into the flow and get into a rhythm on the ice.
Yeah, I expect a meaningful level of intensity right off the hop, to be totally honest with you. Jamie, and I'm curious to get Mike's thoughts on this, you know, because, for example, I think about like the 96 World Cup.
Mm-hmm.
And that was not the Olympics.
Nope.
You know, it was a similar situation where the Olympics hadn't had best on best, but we kind of knew it was coming. And it was kind of almost a setup tournament. And yet, you know, and it was an odd format, right? It was like three-game playoff sort of thing. Playoffs, final series between Canada and the U.S. But I remember watching that as a 9-year-old, and it was intense hockey.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I'm kind of expecting something similar. I think these players have been chomping at the bit. I think the novelty of this, the ability to compete for your country in this type of format or this level of competition, I think that's going to take care of the intensity on its own. And I bet we're going to notice it right from puck drop.
Yeah. And there might be, that's kind of what I'm wondering, right? There might be some tentativeness at first, as, you know, guys playing together and all that, but I don't think it'll take a lot for it to really get ramped up. And, you know, the people texting in like, oh, is this going to be more intense than an All-Star game? It's not going to be even close. It's going to be a completely different thing than what you see. Like, the All-Star game is nothing. The All-Star game is like literally nothing. Zero intensity. The intensity dial turned as low as it can possibly go. Look, is this going to be Olympic gold medal intensity? Probably not, but it's going to be a lot closer to that than All-Star or NHL preseason or something like that. And then again, those big moments, those key moments, maybe it gets ramped up even beyond that. So the matchup Canada and Sweden tonight, and, you know, we were talking in the crossover, you look at the center situation for Sweden. Elias Pettersson could end up being a really, really key figure on that team. But the strength of Team Sweden certainly is on its blue line. And just here's how they'll be lining up on the blue line. Victor Hedman with Jonas Brodin, Mattias Ekholm with Erik Karlsson, Gustav Forsling, and Rasmus Dahlin. So Rasmus Andersson is having a fantastic year for Calgary. He's going to be a healthy scratch tonight. And I'll be curious, you know, reading some of the quotes coming out from the Swedish dressing room today, from the coach and from the players, they were really emphasizing, we're leaning into our skill identity. Our identity is a skill team. And they kind of referenced a lot of the history of Sweden in best on best was more about playing defensive, sitting back, being very conservative. And they kind of want to shed that and forge a new identity here. I'm wondering how that's going to work with the strength they have on the blue line. Like, could we see a lot of, you know, Erik Karlsson, Rasmus Dahlin marauding in the offensive end as they like to do? Will that be a key part of this matchup tonight between Canada and Sweden?
Well, it should be. I mean, that's the engine of that team. You know, they need to be leaning heavily, I think, on what they're able to do with that blue line group. That's going to be how they win. You know, I think their blue line group, you like it better. Certainly, you take Cale Makar ahead of anyone else on either blue line. But aside from that, don't you prefer Sweden as a group to Canada in this game? Like, isn't that their biggest edge?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a net, depending on how you feel about Gustafsson and Binnington. But, I mean, I don't think that's like a knockout blow. It's not Hellebuck Binnington, right? So, you know, I think that's where you look at this as being a mismatch in Sweden's favor, potentially. Now, is it going to matter as much as Canada's edge down the center of their forward group? Probably not, right? I'd expect that to be the decisive sort of factor in why Canada's favored today and why I expect them to win. But, you know, I do think the way that they'll win, if they do, the Sweden, I mean, mm-hmm. is like Vegas does, really leaning on that edge to control the environment of the game. Keep it close and get the key bounce, the extra bounce, the extra moment of finishing brilliance that puts you over the top.
Yeah, and I like just how versatile their blue line group is, right? You know, with maybe the best defensive defenseman in the game and Gustav Forsling, and then you've got Erik Karlsson paired with Mattias Ekholm. That feels like a great fit to get the best out of Erik Karlsson. Rasmus Dahlin, who's so dangerous offensively, and then Hedman, who's just kind of an all-around guy. So it feels like they have guys who can beat you in a bunch of different ways. They can, you know, they have a good matchup guys. They have good offensive guys. A very dangerous group on the blue line for Team Sweden tonight and for the whole tournament, you would expect in the Four Nations face-off. And then, I mean, you know, we've talked about this a little bit as well, but the identity that Team Canada tries to play with, and then the other part of that for me is just how quick are both coaching staffs, but let's stick with John Cooper and Team Canada's staff, how quick are they to make changes, to shuffle things up? Because on the one hand, you know, you don't want to say like, hey, these guys have played three shifts together and it hasn't looked good, so we're going to throw it in a blender and we're going to try to find something new. But if you're down 2-0, you know, 15 minutes into the first period, and this is a short tournament where one loss could not necessarily be fatal, but really, really put you in a dangerous position, you don't exactly have a lot of runway to wait and start to tinker with things. So whichever team falls down, if a team falls down early, I think the temptation to make significant changes is going to be very high. And just in general, if you don't think you're clicking, I don't think you can have a lot of patience with your lineup decisions. You're going to have to make changes pretty quickly.
Oh, without question. I mean, in the first period or certainly by the first intermission.
Yeah.
You know, you can't afford to lose this game if you're going to play for the championship, especially given the format that I know very well.
Now you're an expert on it.
Yeah, I've really studied up on it because I think it's vitally important. They need to win today. You need to win today because you might not be favored against the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that that's the team to like beat, not necessarily the favorite, but the team that Canada we know is going to have to beat if they're going to win this. And we don't want to see Canada not win this, especially in this environment.
Yeah, I want Canada to win, but you know how in basketball, Team USA like loses the World Cup or comes really close to losing the World Cup because they send their B team and then they get in a panic. Not that we've sent our B team, but then they get in a panic and all of the best players are like, well, we got to go to the Olympics now. And then they have a dominant Olympics team. Like there is that possibility here, right? If Canada loses where it's like, oh, we got to take this really seriously, the Olympics, to reestablish what we're doing. So that would be like the silver lining for me if Canada loses. But ultimately, yes, let's go. Let's go get this done and win this tournament. I'll run through just the lineup for Team Canada. It hasn't changed a ton since they first skated at practice on Monday, but it will be Connor McDavid with Mitch Marner and Sam Reinhart. Nathan MacKinnon, who's moved back to center, with Sidney Crosby on his left wing, Mark Stone on his right wing. Braden Point between Brad Marchand and Seth Jarvis. Anthony Cirelli with Brandon Hagel and Travis Konecny on the fourth line. Sam Bennett, the healthy scratch at forward. On the blue line, it's Taves and Makar, Shea Theodore and Drew Doughty, Josh Morrissey, and Colton Parayko. Travis Sanheim is the healthy scratch. We've talked a lot about the star power up front for Team Canada, and then also, of course, you've got Cale Makar on the blue line. How would you evaluate the rest of Canada's defense corps? You know, Drew Doughty, the Team Canada veteran, drawing in place of Alex Pietrangelo. What are you kind of expecting to see from the guys on that blue line beyond Cale Makar?
Yeah, I mean, I'm expecting to see, I mean, they're really good defensively, right? Like, that's the thing I think that's key about this defensive group is, you know, I think there's a lot of defensive talent outside of the Makar Taves pair, now, which obviously also is a good defensive pair. But, you know, I think there's a fairly significant reliance in terms of how this D-core is built on, you know, that top pair to carry the mustard offensively. Like, I think the Parayko, taking Parayko to this tournament is kind of a tell, where obviously defensive skill was a primary priority in assembling this roster. And, you know, as such, I think the key for Vancouver's blue, or Vancouver, Canada's blue line, is going to be determined effectively by how well they prevent goals with those depth, the other blue liners on, right? Like, that's that's what's going to matter. That's what they're built to do. Play sort of simple hockey with the Makar Taves pair taking a breather and really rely on the environment they'll be able to create with that top pair on the ice to drive a positive goal differential.
Yeah, and you would expect to see, I think, a lot of Makar on the ice with the MacKinnon and McDavid lines as part of that, kind of how you see Makar out there with MacKinnon all the time in Colorado, or, you know, a lot of Bouchard with McDavid in Edmonton, the you know, Hughes with JT Miller when he was here with the Canucks, that attempt to really create that five-man unit that can dominate offensively. And then, yeah, I mean, you look at, like, the fourth line for Canada of Cirelli and Brandon Hagel and Konechny. There's offensive talent there. Konechny's really talented. Hagel scored a ton of goals. You know, Cirelli's a great player, but probably relied on more in the matchup sense, or just to, you know, not get scored on and then let MacKinnon and McDavid go out and do the work offensively. Although I will say, I don't know if he counts as under the radar, because I think he was one of the first six guys selected. But, like, Braden Point as the third line center, Braden Point is an outrageously talented offensive player. So I see what you're saying about the blue line, where it's, okay, Makar, Taves, and then the depth guys kind of just go out there and don't get scored on. But up front, man, they have some outrageous offensive talent up and down that lineup.
Yes. I mean, no doubt. And you know, I'm thinking about this more as, you know, the five-man unit thing, right? Maybe if Jared Bednar was the head coach. But we've seen, you know, Cooper's Tampa Bay Lightning teams, especially in their sort of 2.0 variation, this dog version of the Tampa Bay Lightning that they found ahead of making three straight Stanley Cup finals earlier this decade. And, I mean, think about the defenders that have cycled through there. Right. Or even think about the fact that they decided to trade Sergachev and bring back Ryan McDonagh as sort of an indication, as it were, of how Cooper wants his defenders to support the attack. Right. I mean, it's not that Tampa Bay Lightning plays a conservative style or sits back. It's not that you never see Victor Hedman or J.J. Moser or our guy Nick Perbix join the rush and take fourth man's ice. But the forwards are relied on to sort of be the driving force offensively, and they're willing to play lockdown defense and have a less mobile defense core that's a little bit more focused on in-zone coverage and, you know, long-range shots and just sort of supporting the attack in that manner. You know, in some ways, the Makar Taves of this all, right, the idea of Cooper coaching a team with a player like Makar who can flip the ice in a moment, or a player like Taves who is almost more of like a holding midfielder in terms of his style of defensive play than, you know, your typical like shutdown defenseman. It's almost an interesting fit given how we've seen Cooper's teams approach winning games in the past, and especially with the tell of how the second and third pairs are built, with an emphasis on size and defense, which feels a little bit more Tampa Bay Lightning. So I am curious to see exactly how that all works together, given the coaching talent that Hockey Canada or that Canada's brought to this tournament, you'd imagine that they'll have some interesting ideas to sort through it all.
Jordan Binnington starts in net for Canada. Philip Gustafsson starts for Sweden. And we should note as well, Elias Pettersson skating with Adrian Kempe and Philip Forsberg for Sweden, one of their top six lines, and could really, I think he's on the second power play unit, or at least he has been at practice the last couple of days. So not getting the first power play unit look, Elias Pettersson, but could be counted on as a key offensive piece for Team Sweden. Should mention, Dom's model up at the Athletic has also transitioned to Four Nations mode for this tournament. It's got odds for the different teams to win. He has Canada narrowly ahead with a 38% chance to win, USA at 37%. So basically a dead heat. And that matches how we're all talking about it, right? Kind of co-favorites, not a lot to pick between them. Wouldn't be a shock at all to see either of those teams win the tournament. He's got Canada at a 38% chance to win, USA 37%. Sweden 18%. Finland with a 6% chance. But as you said, short tournament. With what Finland can do at international hockey, their identity, all of that, don't count out the Finns completely. All right, that's getting you set up for Canada versus Sweden tonight in Montreal. We'll take a quick break here. Jason Bukla will join us on the other side. Looking forward to chatting with Books about his thoughts about this tournament, the matchup, how Canada's going to play, concern in goal, all of those things, what he wants to see from Elias Pettersson at the tournament. We'll get into all of it with Jason Bukla. That's next here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Sportsnet 650 with Jamie Dodd and Thomas Drance. We are broadcasting live from the Kintech studio. Kintech Footwear and Orthotics working together with you in step. 650, 650, of course, is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Denny's True North taste awaits with Denny's 100% Canadian beef burgers made with new shredded iceberg lettuce on a brioche bun and all the classic ingredients you love. Now joining us, as he always does on a Wednesday, from Sportsnet, former director of amateur scouting in the NHL as well, he is our pal, Jason Bukla. Books, what's going on, man?
What's up, fellas? Not too much. How you doing?
I'm doing well. I am really, really excited for Canada and Sweden tonight. How are you feeling about this one?
I'm actually looking forward to it. Yeah, a little change of pace back half of the season here. Curious to see how these high-octane rosters perform and how the goaltending looks. Gustafsson for Sweden, I see, so that should be interesting. And obviously Binnington for Canada, so...
We can talk about the goaltending at some point for sure, but let's take the crease out of it for a second. So beyond the goaltending question, which we've all been, you know, concerned about for a long time with Canada, but beyond that, what's your kind of biggest question? And I don't even mean like what's a flaw or something that could really hurt them, but what's just kind of has you most curious about with Team Canada going into this tournament?
Curious to see one thing was asked of me earlier today, how the lines will be deployed in terms of ice time. And when you've got four lines that are as deep as they are for all of the rosters, really, you know, how are they going to roll over the boards and what's the game plan? And I really think that when you're looking at the McKinnons and the McDavids centering your top two lines, that you want to try and play them as close to the same amount of time as they normally do get with their club teams, because that's when they perform at their best, and you know, you don't want to cut it back too much. So I'm curious to just see how at even strength the matchups go, and if they are matchups or if it's just like, you know, the John Cooper is just daring the opponent to defend against their top players. Another thing I'm interested in is you know, Drew Doughty coming back. He's only been back for a short period of time here. I'm interested to see, just on the defensive side, you know, how hard it is to come back after injury. And now you're thrust into a tournament like this where it's going to be really fast, high execution type hockey. I'm interested to see how the veteran, the wily vet, defends in his own zone.
Books, from a Canucks perspective going into this tournament, there's a lot of eyes on Elias Pettersson and whether he can refined his game, refined some of the juice that we saw him play with against the Maple Leafs on Saturday, but have seen far too infrequently over the course of this entire season. What are your expectations for Pettersson, and how much weight will you put into what you see over the course of the next 10 days?
I think it's important for him. I think that it's important. It's more important for certain players, and I think that I'm putting him in that kind of bracket as well. This is the first time, you know, this type of high-end best-on-best has been played for an eternity, like 10 years, and it's his first opportunity to be part of Sweden's team against, this type of an opponent. And, you know, by all accounts, it looks like he's going to play with Kempe and Forsberg, and he's going to have to push the pace on that line and make plays. And I think it's important. You know, the Canucks went into the break closer to the best version of themselves, and he's still not there. So I think that, for me personally, I'm looking for him to have hopefully a much better performance and take that back. You know, that's going to be his takeaway coming back. This could be a nice little reset for him. I know that sounds kind of crazy, but it could be a nice little reset for him to springboard him to the rest of the season. And I know Team Sweden's obviously going to be expecting it. So he wanted pressure, and he's going to get it.
What are you expecting just generally from the competitive environment of this tournament?
Well, I think they're going to want to get after it. I think it's going to take about a half a minute. I really do. I think that, right in warm-up tonight in Montreal, the building will be buzzing. As there's certain buildings in the league. You know, Vancouver can get like that too, where it can be very electric, and Montreal is going to be 20-plus thousand fans that are going to be excited about this, and I think that it's going to be really, really high-end hockey. And it feels to me like it's really been building. You know, you see them getting interviewed now, and they've had a couple of practices under their belt wearing the national jersey, and you can feel the excitement. So, yeah, I'm anticipating the first 10 minutes is going to be really hectic, and it'll settle down a bit after that, but it'll be very, very competitive, enthusiastic for sure.
Looking at Team Sweden for a second, you know, you mentioned all eyes on Elias Pettersson, certainly here in Vancouver at this tournament. But, you know, I think most people see them as the likely third best team at this event. And you just look down the middle for them, right? With Pettersson, obviously, we know about his struggles this year. Zibanejad has taken a ton of heat for his play with the Rangers. He's actually been bumped to the wing with the Rangers since JT Miller arrived. He's holding down a center spot. And then you have, you know, Joel Eriksson Ek, great player, but not necessarily a high-end offensive driver, and Elias Lindholm. How big a concern is that that lineup down the middle for Sweden?
Yeah, when you get to the 3 and the 4 for the Swedes, and I'm just talking about the entire construction of the lineup, it is interesting because in the middle of the ice, in the 3 and the 4, more the 4, it's definitely a drop-off compared to some of the other rosters. And so from a line matching perspective, if that does happen, and I think it will occur to a degree, they're going to be really pressed. In the 3, like Eriksson Ek is supposed to be centering, I believe, Lucas Raymond and Jesper Bratt. And, those are two really good flanks for him. So he's going to have to be at the top of his game to get pucks down low and feed them and join the rush and transition pucks. Zibanejad is going to be very interesting. I know you're talking about, all 4, but Zibanejad is going to center Nylander. And you know how Nylander can be. Like, he can be, tracking up and down 100 miles an hour and doing fantastic things all night long. Or he can kind of take half a shift off now and again. And Zibanejad, to your point, hasn't been excellent this year. So they got some holes there. Those guys are going to have to elevate. And they'll be pressed, especially if they start without the puck.
So you mentioned it earlier, and I said we'd get to it at some point. Jordan Binnington gets the start in goal for Canada. What did you think of the decision from John Cooper and his staff? What do you expect to see from Binnington in this tournament?
Kind of what I expected, that he would be the guy. What do I expect to see? I'm not too sure, to be honest with you. Going into the event, it was very uneven from all the goaltenders that are on Canada's roster, and Hill is in that mix too. And in four of his last six starts. Aiden Hill, that is, he gave up three or more goals against, and Binnington's save percentage was hovering somewhere around .888 over his last 10 starts. So I'm not sure, but you know, you just need him to catch lightning in a bottle for 10 days here, and or just under 10 days, and he's a Stanley Cup champion. He knows what it takes in high leverage situations, but you know, you can't sugarcoat it. That's what's going to stand out here. Can the roster, if Binnington's just average, can they outscore their goaltending? And I would suggest that they probably could. They could win a game 4-3 or 5-4. That's possible. But you know, it's always interesting when a goaltender is just okay if he's letting 2, 3, maybe 4. You know, it's not so much that you've let in three; it's how do you react and make sure that the fourth one doesn't go in. So he's going to need to touch it. Feel the puck, you know, in the first 10 minutes tonight and hopefully get off to a good start. And but make no question or make no mistake about it, they know that all eyes are on their goaltending. So they're going to play hard in front of them as well.
Books, outside of the blue paint, what's your biggest question about this Team Canada?
Curious on the back end. You know, what goes on with, like, I really like the makeup of it. Obviously got Taves and Makar familiar with each other. I touched on Doughty out of the box here, just, you know, up to speed. You know, Shea Theodore is solid. Pareko's been the guy that, you know, on balance, he's had a solid season. I get it. But he's the guy that I want to watch closely in this event here. I just feel like there were some really good candidates that were lurking in the weeds there to potentially be a part of the roster. And other than that, you know, up front, you got some youth, right? Like, let's see how Seth Jarvis integrates into this lineup and what his role is. And then let's see what's left in the tank for Brad Marchand as well. Let's see if he can play that type of agitating style, but up to speed and do the other things that he does very well. So, you know, there's lots to unpack there. The power play guys, I guess I should probably end it with that. I'm curious to see what this looks like and just how elite it really is.
With the way that this roster is constructed, with all the sort of things you hit on there, you know, the excitement about what this team could look like with the man advantage, for example, do you have any hot takes in terms of what to expect at this tournament? Like, is there something you're, you know, thinking over that maybe would seem a little out there to our audience, but that you're confident people will all agree on in a week's time?
Oh my God, what a loaded question that is. I don't, you know what, I don't know if there's anything that everybody can agree on. I think that, you know, the American team is, to me, and I know we're obviously rooting for Canada. And I'm wearing the jersey for the next little bit as well. Like, I'm obviously a Canadian and I'm pulling for Team Canada. But I am curious with the American team to just see how Connor Hellebuyck plays in the next week. And I really do think that it's very important for his psyche, the takeaway out of this tournament. In Winnipeg, you know, the Jets have been fantastic, and he's the defending Vezina Trophy winner, and he's on record saying he feels like he's in his prime and playing the best hockey he's ever played right now. And the thing of it is, guys, that his playoff numbers have fallen off quite substantially over the years for the Jets, and that's the one thing I'm curious in this high-leverage tournament. Let's see what he's capable of and what the takeaway is. And if it's really positive, that could be really good news for Winnipeg when he returns to Winnipeg, because they need him to be better come spring and hopefully early summer if they want to go on a deep playoff run. And there's another player on the American roster that is legitimately one of my favorite younger guys in the league. Brock Faber, I think, is an absolute workhorse. And I'm curious to see how, you know, Adam Fox, I understand the way he plays and I understand his pedigree offensively, but Brock Faber is the ultimate glue guy who can play the game a variety of ways. And I'm curious to see the evolution of him continue on the world stage here, because he's super elite, guys.
Putting you on the spot a little bit, but do you think this is the strongest roster the Americans have been able to field at a best on best?
I do. It's different than, you know, it's been so long since we've seen, you know, this true type of makeup. And I do believe that this is their best. You know, they got a real mix of youth. You know, you look at Hughes and the Boldies, and, you know, even Dylan Larkin's not that old yet. Obviously, you got the Chuck brothers in there. But, you know, like I just mentioned with Faber, and then, you know, in the two hole and net, like Ottinger, if he's the two, he could be the starter on maybe every other team in the tournament right now, I would say. So,
yep.
You know, it's the deepest team, and I think it's something that we should all get used to. The American the structure, the program, from the grassroots level all the way up through the national team and then the U-20 level, et cetera, et cetera. They've been on the rise for several years, and this is something to get used to. They're going to have really good teams for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, it certainly looks that way. Shifting back to the Canucks here just for a second, obviously, you know, they've got some time off just like every other NHL team, and we're all kind of curious how busy they'll be, how busy the league as a whole will be, but certainly Brock Besser's name now, you know, less than a month to go before the deadline. Everything we hear is talks between the two sides are quiet, pretty far apart, maybe still on a contract. Given that the Canucks, you know, are in a playoff spot, they obviously have aspirations of being a playoff team and, you know, trying to put themselves in the best position possible once they get there. How difficult a situation is this for them to navigate over the next few weeks with a pending unrestricted free agent as high quality and as important as Brock Besser is?
It's not ideal. And I guess I would suggest to you guys that if they had already, like if they were in the same slot as, you know, Vegas, and you know, if they had 70 points, I think Vegas has got 72, but if they're right in that type of a mix, I think the conversation would feel a lot differently, and you'd be talking for sure own rental type of scenario and see how it goes. And I know that when I say that, that doesn't sound ideal either, but the fact of the matter is this, the cap is going up a lot, guys. So it's not like, you know, you have to go out and get a pick for Brock Besser right now just because, you know, you need to get a pick to recoup some draft capital or whatever the case may be. I don't see the urgency that way. I think that the Canucks are starting to feel good about themselves again. We've talked about this ad nauseum, and it's one of those situations where you're going to have to roll the dice now. I'm not paying him $8 million a year. I'm going to tell you that right now out of the box. That's not happening, and that's probably what he's looking to get. You know, you're just going to have to manage it as best you can. Hope for your playoff team. He's better when he's going. When he's at his best, he makes him a better team. For now, I don't see it long-term contract-wise. But you'll get a pick for him before the draft anyways if you just want to relinquish his rights. So you're going to have to roll it out. It's not ideal, but that's just how I feel about it right now, provided that they continue to play something close to what they ended the break with here.
Books, when thinking about this Canucks team, they only have 6 games left between now and the deadline. So while it's weeks away, you know, it's not like they're going to get that much more information on their team or their positioning or their playoff odds between now and the deadline. Now, I know they brought in Marcus Pettersson, a guy who they identified partly because of his leadership skills. But given how this season has gone, you know, would it make sense in your mind for the Canucks to really prioritize an additional, like, character player or two between now and the deadline?
Yeah, I mean, it's been so topsy-turvy. If they continue to give me reason here in the next, they've got Vegas, right out of the box when they return.
Right out of the gate, yeah.
Yeah, so you know, right away, you're going to get a feel with their schedule in a 5-game segment. I would suggest, you know, what the trajectory looks like. And it's not going to, if they continue to give you reason to believe, yeah, I'd be continuing to look to improve the team. I don't think they were anywhere, like, let's really take the wider view of things. For as much noise and chaos that surrounded the group, you know, they really did stay alive, if you will. Like, you know, it didn't go right in the tank. So They've got that opportunity, I guess, to potentially continue to add that type of player. And yeah, I'm not afraid to invest more draft capital, given what I know about the current draft cycle, and they've got some prospects in the pipeline, but I would not be giving up some of these high-end prospects. I know that the Dylan Cousins name, for example, has been circulating a little bit. Now, that's one that I would potentially go after, I have to say, because of his youth. But outside of him, I'm not giving up, the Willanders and the Karamakis and some of these players in trade. It's just not happening. So it depends on what the cost is to get the character.
With Willander, who won the Beanpot with BU or just this week, you know, his production's actually down this year. He got off to a hot offensive start. But his point totals have regressed as BU has gone through the season. And yet, you know, he made a great feed to Cole Hudson, setting up sort of the game winner in that Beanpot game. How do you kind of look at what you've seen out of Willander in totality? You know, how his BU season has gone, how the World Juniors has gone, the fact that, you know, the one area for obvious growth was sort of being more assertive offensively, and after a really hot start on that front, he sort of tapered off, at least from a scoring perspective. Where are you at with sort of where his development is trending, you know, especially given that with this new look Canucks blue line, I think we expect to see Willander, if he doesn't get games, at least sign with the Canucks and be a player in terms of maybe taking a job at training camp next fall.
Yeah, no, he's going to get a game this year. I would fully anticipate that at the end of the season. Yeah, that's going to, you know how that goes. That's sneaking up on you here in a hurry, and that's going to happen. I think that to your point, the offense, and you were on this, Drancer was on this to tell all of the world that he really didn't believe in necessarily the execution being high end for an NHL prospect. And I think that it is at times. I just don't think it is all the time. So having said that, he's gonna use his legs, and he's gonna use his ability to get places quicker than opponents, to be a two-way D and potentially provide some secondary depth offense, and that's gonna be fine. So you know, the main thing you're gonna see out of him is the ability to get places ahead of people and use what he does really well to his advantage. And the Canucks, I look at Pettersson on the back end now, not Marcus, Elias.
Yeah.
How do we, Elias. Yeah, I don't make that mistake. Like, it's unbelievable. Please don't spell your name the same way and make me pronounce it two different ways. But anyways, I look at that and I say to myself, well, that could work, right? Like that could work. You got a shutdown kind of a guy, a two-way shutdown guy, and then you got a guy with the wheels with a little bit of secondary offense. So, it'll be interesting, but I'm not banking on the offense. I don't need it. I need him to be the best version of himself as a two-way D with Hronek in the lineup and Hughes in the lineup. We got other guys that can do that, and that's okay.
Yeah, as you said, I mean, we're coming up here. Well, all of a sudden, we could be, what, like 6 weeks away from him suiting up for the Vancouver Canucks. And, you know, as you said, you expect him to get a game. Sometimes we see it where it's kind of almost a reward or an incentive. Hey, we'll get you into an NHL game if you sign here. But for Willander, with the rest, like, how does the rest of his game figure to contribute to an NHL lineup right away? Is it the kind of thing where, okay, you want to get him a game just so you can get him a game? Or could this be a guy that is one of the, you know, the six choices for Rick Tocchet and Adam Foote to put into potentially really important games down the stretch?
Tough one. The whole let's get a game thing is more him telling the
exactly
that I'm burning a year off my contract.
Yeah.
So I want to sign, but you got to get me in a game. Beyond that, everything will have to be earned after that. I honestly don't see how. I guess it's going to depend on what happens with Susie here down the stretch, and you know they've got some decisions to make on the trajectory of certain players. I don't see it being part of the solution come playoff time. He might be a black ace, but I don't see it yet, guys. It needs time still, and that time is going to have to be developed at the American Hockey League level to start, which is fine. But I don't see it being something that you can roll out in high octane, you know, 12 minutes a night, 14 minutes a night in early April and into May, hopefully, for the Canucks. If he does that, I'll be surprised, but it would be a nice problem to have on our hands. But it's a heavy lift, and I can't sit here today and say that he's a for sure third pairing 10 to 12 minute kill penalty guy yet for the Canucks in high leverage games.
So I'll leave you with this one, Books. Looking ahead pretty far in the future here to next season, the 2025-2026 Canucks, which of Willander, Elias Pettersson, Jonathan Lekkerimäki, their three top prospects, who is most likely to meaningfully contribute to next year's NHL team for the Canucks?
Yeah, Lekkerimäki and Pettersson. It's going to take Willander a little bit of time, which is fine. And I'm actually, you know, because Lekkerimäki, it's the goal scoring thing, which is hard to do. Like right now, like I've had a scout's crush on Pettersson for a couple of years, fellas. So like it's one of those things where this guy never lets me down, but he'll contribute in a different way. But Lekkerimäki's got enough in there to go off, similar to the way Matt Carinato's kind of having a year this year in Calgary, that kind of stuff. So I think Lekkerimäki and Pettersson and Willander will take a little bit of time in the minors, which is no problem. I'm good with that.
Books, really appreciate it. Enjoy the game tonight. We will chat next week.
Awesome, boys. As usual, enjoy the hockey. We'll talk.
Thank you. That is Jason Bukala from Sportsnet's NHL coverage and, of course, former director of amateur scouting as well, joining us as he always does on a Wednesday. And up next, really looking forward to this, we will chat with Mike Modano, Hockey Hall of Famer, of course, veteran of Team USA at Best on Best events, a silver medalist with Team USA at the Olympics, won the World Cup of Hockey with them in 1996. I think he was on the ground in Montreal around Team USA as well. So we'll look back at his Best on Best career. We'll talk about this year's event and this year's edition of Team USA with Mike Modano next. Denny's True North Taste awaits with Denny's 100% Canadian beef burgers made with new shredded iceberg lettuce on a brioche bun and all the classic ingredients you love. Mike Modano joins the show next here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd and Thomas Drantz. We are live from the Kintex studio. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and rental warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at dunbarlumber.com. Best on Best International Men's Hockey is back. Canada versus Sweden in Montreal tonight to get the Four Nations face-off underway. Team USA will take on Finland tomorrow as the other two teams get going. And now joining us, as mentioned, he is a Hockey Hall of Famer, of course, long, long time NHL player, Stanley Cup champion, and also a veteran of many tournaments with Team USA. He is Mike Modano. Mike, thanks so much for joining us today. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's our pleasure. And, you know, I'm just so excited to have Best on Best Hockey back for hockey, for the sport. And, you know, is this tournament not ideal for a lot of ways and not enough teams? Sure, I get all that, but I'm just really excited. And, you know, for you, as I mentioned, look, you did so much at the NHL level, played for so long, but you also played in, by my count, six Best on Best tournaments for Team USA. And, you know, then you had the World Juniors in there as well. Like, you played a lot for Team USA. What does that part of your legacy mean for you looking back on your career?
Well, you feel that you were a little bit lucky at times and pretty appreciative and grateful that you had a chance to play for your country. And I think the most exciting thing was being on a team and in a locker room with the other best players of your country. So I think it was always good. The camaraderie was always fun. I think we were always able to you know, set our personal accolades and our egos aside for the betterment of the team for the most part when we go into these tournaments. And no one really is above anybody else. It's all even playing field for us as far as the team's concerned. But yeah, there's a lot of hype, a lot of excitement when you go into these tournaments, and you know, you obviously want to do well collectively and individually, and certainly when you have the best players of these countries involved, you know, the stakes are high, and hopefully, you know, I'm sure the fans will be well entertained, and some of the best players in the game, obviously, right now. So should equal up some good hockey.
Yeah, you mentioned just kind of how fortunate you felt to get the opportunity, and you know, you earned the opportunity, obviously, but you were fortunate in the sense of your career lined up really well with kind of the closest we've had to a consistent calendar for international hockey, right? I mean, you played in the final edition of the Canada Cup in 91, and then the first edition of the World Cup of Hockey in 96, Olympic Games, another World Cup. You had the opportunity to go represent your country on a consistent basis. And, you know, I was looking, I mean, guys who are at like the 91 Canada Cup and the 2006 Olympics, I think it's like you and Nick Lidstrom. So it's a pretty select group. But how important is it for the sport to just get back to that consistency, get back to giving this generation of players, you know, the same opportunities that you and your peers had for it to be a regular part of their hockey experience?
No, yeah, that's a great point. I think it just all kind of the stars aligned in the 90s for everything that happened with us as far as moving into the World Cup, and then obviously having NHL players allowed to play in the Olympics going into Nagano, and you know, our success, the gold medal game in 02 against Canada in Salt Lake. And, you know, so you had all these great, great experiences, great tournaments, in the 90s. So it is nice to see that this evolvement into this, best on best, and, to see how this thing plays out leading up to, the tournaments and, the Olympics in Milan next year. So, yeah, it's great for the players. I think the players are more excited about it. They look forward to these type of things when they're on the calendar. So it's excited to kind of break up the season. You get a chance to go play with some of the best players and see some high-end skill, and then you know, it does a lot for your confidence when you're involved in these tournaments, when you do come back to your regular team, and then there's going to be the mad sprint going into the playoffs. So there's still a lot of hockey to go when they get back from this tournament. So you know, we'll see how that all that plays out as well.
Mike, you had an opportunity to have dinner with this current version of Team USA in Montreal, you know, a couple members from the Miracle on Ice team, Guy Gaudreau as well. How did that dinner come about, and what was the overall vibe from this Team USA going into this tournament?
Well, I think there's obviously a lot of excitement. There always is going into it, the lead up to the start, and just kind of waiting for this thing to get going. So they've been in Montreal for 3 or 4 days, kind of chomping at the bit to get started. So you got one more night, then they get going. But the dinner was great. You know, having a Ruzioni and McClanahan, those were guys that, you know, were big parts of our experience as a kid watching, having the first experience of international hockey, and what that 1980s team did for hockey and for our country and for everything that was going on in the world. It had a big impact on our country. So, you know, those were guys and experiences that kind of molded us as players, and something that we look back to kind of emulate when we got into international play, to be, you know, to have the same success as those guys did. So it was always a goal in the back of our minds to kind of emulate what they had. But the dinner was great. I mean, the guys are really good guys. A lot of guys I hadn't met in a long time, and I haven't seen or got a chance to meet. But yeah, it was great. And obviously Mr. Gaudreau there in hand was very sentimental, emotional to have him there and have him part of that tournament, and knowing what he's going through to be there. You could tell he was choked up about being there, and but it was great to have him there as well. But I think it was all spearheaded by Billy Guerin. He just thought it'd be neat to have some of the old guard and some of the couple of us, me that was closer to these guys in the 90s and 2000s that remember those tournaments. So But it was a relaxed night, very good night. But yeah, it's, I'm amazed at how big these guys are nowadays. I'm standing up to them. I thought I was kind of big as a player at 6'2", 6'3". But I mean, there's some big, thick guys that can skate and move and handle the puck. I mean, the game's at a good spot right now, the speed and skill. But, you know, USA's got some, they got a little bit of grit to them too. So it's going to be interesting how that plays out in these games too, because it will be a drag match.
Your greatest triumph on the international stage, also one of the most crushing blows for me personally watching as a 9-year-old, was the 1996 World Cup, Mike. When you think about that tournament, I mean, it wasn't the Olympics. You know, World Cup hadn't been played all that frequently when it occurred, but I remember it having a pretty high level of intensity on both sides. What do you remember about that stretch of games?
Well, I think the obviously the format and the whole schedule was obviously a little bit different. We all reported to Providence, Rhode Island for about 7-8 days prior to the tournament. So there's a lot of, you know, there was some build up there. The guys were getting in shape, kind of getting ready. It was before training camp, so there was really no no chance of guys not being there because of injuries in the season or whatever. But, you know, everybody went in there 100% healthy. And we played a Russian team in the final and semis that were, it was just an unbelievable lineup. But Canada had their hands full with Sweden going in overtime and I think double overtime at that point. But so they kind of got lucky to get through that. But, you know, losing the first game in Philly in overtime on Yzerman's goal and knowing that we had to go back to the Forum, where the mecca of hockey is, pretty much to have to win two in a row at the old Forum. You know, we knew our work was cut out for us, but we shocked him in game two. And then at that point then on, it was just really like, I think Terry Gregson just kind of put the whistle away. There was like no rules. I mean, it was just all holds, you know, cage match, kind of just who could slash or cross check or high stick or elbow someone the hardest was ended up winning, because it just got ugly early. And Tkachuk got kicked out with foot. You know, Lindros two-handed over the back of Tkachuk's head, and guys were fighting and getting hit. And I mean, it was just it's a prime example of old school hockey with no rules for 60 minutes. It was ugly. But, you know, then we're, you know, down 2-1 with about, I don't know, 3 minutes left in the game. And then it's just like, you know, we scored three goals and it was just an amazing final 3 minutes of that game. I just couldn't believe it. So it was just, you know, Mike Richter was just phenomenally just at another level that no one's ever seen in international play, I don't think, since. So it was some tough hockey, and we're glad we came out on the front end of that.
Yeah, so not lacking intensity is what you're saying.
No,
and some of the characters who were involved in that, yeah, they tend to bring it when they were on the ice. How about this? A huge triumph for Team USA, beating Canada, as you said, in the Forum in those two games to take home. Are you taking that edition of Team USA or this year's at the Four Nations? Who are you taking in a game, one game elimination?
Oh, man. I'm telling you, it's pretty stacked up. I think, you know, the lineups are pretty strong. I think, you know, I think Sweden could be a little bit of a sleeper, but I mean, watching Canada's power play with those five guys out there was just something phenomenal, just working it around. But, you know, I think the USA team by far probably will dress the most talented team they've probably ever had in a long time. So probably even more than the 96 team or even 02. So just a lot of, you know, and that's the way the game is. It's just everybody's high skill. The defense could be easily be forwards. They're leading the rush. They're coming back. So, you know, just the overall skill that's kind of come about this game has just been amazing to watch. So, you know, Canada, U.S. Saturday night would be is going to be a good one. But, you know, the lead up to the final in Boston on Monday night. But, I mean, it's a boy, it's a coin toss. I think USA is a little favored in net with Hellebuck and Ottinger. You know, and then I think forward-wise, I don't think, you know, can get any deeper with U.S. So you got some skill and some toughness with the Tkachuks everybody else that could throw a little edge in there if it has to be.
We're chatting with Hockey Hall of Famer Mike Modano here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650, getting you set for the Four Nations. And as you said, one difference with this tournament compared to some of them that you played in, and even the Olympic Games, which are, you know, mid-season, but it's just such a fast tournament, right? All, four games max. If you lose one in the round robin, you put yourself really behind the eight ball to even get to the championship game. How, what's the process like for, you know, elite players coming together for a short tournament who are used to playing one role for their NHL team, and then all of a sudden midstream trying to kind of fit together and find that chemistry in a hurry? What goes into that at these events?
Well, yeah, that's a lot. There's a lot to work through in a matter of 3 or 4 days. And, you know, I think the premise is just having a firm foundation just to work with them. You know, they understand the magnitude of these games and how you got to play. You have to have a little bit of structure and coverage in your own zone. You just can't freewheel and just hope it's just kind of up and down hockey. You have to throttle it down a little bit. You have to play some good defense and eliminate, you know, those guys as much as possible. But, you know, and I don't think for the U.S. or anything, you take away from their game. I think you just kind of add to it, just throw a little responsibility in the game a little bit at certain times, and, you know, don't just expect to go in there and, you know, win 9-8 or 8-7. I think it's going to be, you know, some great chances at both ends. I think it's going to come down, obviously, it always does, the goaltending, maybe special teams in there. But as far as 5-on-5, I mean, it's just going to be some guys just flying around and everybody involved in the rush, everybody involved in the offensive zone moving around. So coverage has to be good, and, you know, eliminating second, third chances and, you know, being able to move that puck away from your own net and out of your zone quick as possible and get out of there. So it's, but it's a lot to manage in about 4 or 5 days. You just hope that it just comes together. Everybody just kind of buys into the small, the big picture at the end of the day and see how it plays out. But, that's what makes this thing so interesting to watch and be a spectator just to see how that plays out.
Mike, there was sort of a golden era of American hockey, you know, with yourself and Jeremy Roenick and Keith Tkachuk and Brett Hull, you know, all sort of born between 65 and 75 and obviously sort of crested in the mid-90s and made an impact. But for the most part, across the last 35, 40 years, you know, America's come to these tournaments with their hard hat on and leaning on good goaltending and sort of toughness. And when you consider just the volume of skill right now in the NHL among American-born players, I mean, the best goal scorer in the league, Jack Eichel, Kyle Connor, all the defensemen, all the goaltenders, how do you reflect on the evolution of hockey in the United States, given the amount of talent, the volume of talent currently dominating the NHL?
Well, I kind of go back to the moment when Gretzky got traded to LA. I think that was kind of really what spearheaded, you know, a lot of interest in the game, certainly in California. But then you had that massive expansion that went on in the early 90s with San Jose, Anaheim, all the Florida teams, Dallas, Minnesota going to Dallas. And, so you had all these areas of the country that never had seen hockey before, let alone been to a game before. So, I guess in over time you had kids who started to like the game. They wanted to go watch. They wanted to play. And then all of a sudden, you know, 10 years later, you have a lot of these kids that are going off to juniors or college or the USHL or, you know, Western League or whatever, that are more American born. So you're actually pulling from a deeper pool of players. And, you know, now you just, and you see kind of what, you know, how it's kind of evolved, where you just have so much more players, more access, more players to pull from in a pool than you had before. You know, before it was just Minnesota, Michigan, Boston, New York, that kind of thing. Now it's, you know, it's coast to coast. You got these kids that are plucking up out of nowhere that are going off to have some good careers in college, juniors in the NHL. But, you know, certainly at this particular time, you have the Hughes brothers and
I mean, God, Austin Eichel. I mean, you go on with the whole list of guys that are there. It's just they're top end guys, not even not just for America, but in the NHL itself. So that's really kind of come a long way.
And Mike, I'm curious to get your take on this, because in addition to your career spanning this really incredible and regularized sort of international competition, you know, you also break into the league in sort of the freewheeling 1980s, right? You were a star player through the so-called dead puck era, and you retire in sort of the cap era, and this moment in time where the game was so based on possession and the goalies were stopping, you know, 91.5% of shots faced. And all of a sudden, we're sort of back to this, you know, 5-4 league where no lead is safe and offensive stats are back to, you know, 140 points for the Art Ross Trophy winner. What do you make of where the state of the game is at today in sort of comparison with all the different stages you saw firsthand as a player throughout your career?
Yeah, it's been it's kind of been an interesting tale of, you know, a couple, you know, swings and pendulum swings in that game where, you know, the late 80s and early 90s, it was a lot of high scoring game. It is today, you know, some of the goaltenders are nowadays are the best athletes on the team. It wasn't that case in the 80s and 90s. They were more the worst, worst shaped guys you could see in the locker room, and they didn't really kind of take care of themselves very well. But nowadays you see, you know, these kids are so big too. They're 6'3", 6'4", 6'5", goalies. I mean, when they go in the butterfly, their shoulders are almost just up to the crossbar still. So, but you had this change in the rules in the 2000s in that lockout that evolved, you know, really kind of changed the whole clutch and grab and interference kind of thing and allowed the skaters to skate. So, you know, and it's evolved into how these guys move. The defense is very active, very offensive. When you have, you know, Quinn and Cal Makar and Hedman and, you know, guys who can move the puck and skate, can lead the rush. You have all these variables that kind of just go into it. But, man, these kids kind of watch these kids do these things on the ice with the stick and shoot the puck. Obviously, the equipment's really changed, the skates, the sticks, everything else that allows these guys to shoot the puck so hard and fast. You know, so, you know, I cringe at having the moment where we would have 3-on-3 back in the day. And, you know, as free flowing as those things are, to be a part of that would have been a lot of fun. So, but yeah, the game's in a good spot. And then you got guys who are putting up some great numbers when the goaltenders are as big as they are. It says a lot about the skill and the talent.
And Mike, a little bit of an offbeat one, but I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about this. So when I think about watching you as a player when I was growing up, you know, just the giant frame reaching full speed through the neutral zone, jersey flapping behind you, like it left such a visceral impression on me as a, you know, a young hockey player, a young hockey fan. To this day, I feel like it's compared, anytime you see a taller player with a lot of speed who's skilled with the puck, you know, it immediately reminds me of watching, you know, you during your career. How often do people bring that up to you?
Oh, quite often. I think that's the number one thing I think people,
I knew it,
that people still say is, you know, man, imagine what you could do with a no clutch and grab system in the neutral zone and not having to carry two guys down the ice to hope to get an opportunity or a shot on net, and the way the defense played in their own zone with, you know, swinging lumber around and cross-checking guys, not having to deal with, you know, a Chris Pronger or a Scott Stevens every night or Adam Foote, you know. You know, nowadays it's very controlled, very policed. I think your high-end guys have a big impact on the game every night. So, but yeah, everybody mentions that right away. What would that look like in this current day? So, I mean, I cringe too how much fun it would have been.
Mike, this was awesome, man. We really appreciate you taking the time to chat with us and kind of go down memory lane. And hey, we're cheering for Canada. I know you're cheering for the USA, but either way, that game on Saturday should be a ton of fun. And thanks for doing this.
Yeah, you got it. Anytime. Good talking with you guys.
That is Mike Modano, Hockey Hall of Famer, and as mentioned, very experienced vet playing with Team USA, really through their golden age. As you said, their biggest triumph in that time coming at the 1996 World Cup of Hockey. And that event, probably the best analog to this. Now, that was a preseason one, right? It was, as he said, so they had the training camp and, you know, there was a whole bunch of exhibition games played before that and there were more teams. So it's not a perfect analogy, but it was the first World Cup of Hockey, right? Previously, it had been the Canada Cup. That ended. They tried to revive it, as you said, to kind of tee up them going to the Olympics. So a lot of similarities. And as you heard him there, and a listener actually sent in a video of Eric Lindros getting into it with Darius Kasparaitis in against Russia in that tournament as well. Like, that tournament did not lack for intensity and rough physical play. So if it is an analogy for this one, I hope Let's that go. Bodes well for what we're going to see.
Yeah. Yeah. That's like absolutely doing the running back, like eating soup thing after first down, like feed me that level of intensity over the next 2 weeks. I would love that.
Yeah, that was awesome, man. What a great chat with Mike Modano to hear about his experiences at these best-on-best tournaments.
I'm so glad everyone brings up the jersey flapping behind him in the neutral zone as he, you know, turned up ice. Because it was, honestly, it's still one of the most, like, if you showed me a silhouette of great hockey players, right, with all the other details removed, he'd be the easiest one to identify, maybe in league history.
I also love how he's listed at 6'3", and he's like, dang, I thought I was big. These guys now are enormous. What's going on here? Thanks to Mike Modano. Thanks to the rest of our guests today as well. Enjoy the hockey tonight, everyone. We'll be back tomorrow. I think Scott Niedermeyer is going to join us tomorrow. So the greats keep on coming here this week on the show, and we'll see. We'll see what we have to break down between Canada and Sweden. That's tomorrow on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650.